This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochrane, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Wednesday, July 17th. Donald Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance, is set to deliver a primetime speech at the Republican National Convention, completing his transformation from fierce Trump critic to top ally. But while Republicans unite, Democrats fracture, as another influential lawmaker calls for Joe Biden to step down. Meanwhile, here at home, premiers continue to vent their frustrations with the federal government. They want Ottawa to butt out of provincial jurisdiction. We're going to start in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It's the third day of the Republican National Convention, and the spotlight is shining on J.D. Vance, Donald Trump's newly minted running mate. And the CBC's Katie Simpson is at the RNC in Milwaukee, and she joins me now. So, Katie, great to see you again, as always. What are we expecting tonight from J.D. Vance?
This is all about his message to Americans. Really, this is the biggest platform he's ever had, and he's going to show the world and American voters exactly why Donald Trump picked him as his running mate. J.D. Vance is known as a populist and an isolationist, and it's no sort of coincidence that tonight's theme at the Republican National Convention is Make America Strong Again, and they're going to be looking at foreign policy. What do we know about J.D. Vance and foreign policy? He supports tariffs. He doesn't want to send any more money to Ukraine. And really, he is an isolationist. He wants to focus on American issues. And they really leaned into that when they first announced that J.D. Vance was nominated as the vice president. He walked out on the floor of the convention hall here, and they played a song called American First, talking about fixing issues in America before fixing issues elsewhere. But another key aspect of tonight's speech is expected to focus on the Republicans' economic message and trying to make life more affordable for particularly Americans in lower income communities and those working class Americans, leaning into J.D. Vance's past. He, of course, is the author of the best-selling memoir, Hillbilly Elegy. And really detailing his life growing up in Appalachia, dealing with family members with addiction, poverty, and class struggle in the United States. And we got a little snippet of what that's probably going to sound like. J.D. Vance spoke at a fundraiser this afternoon, and he leaned into that economic message that Donald Trump wants him to deliver.
The guy who actually connects with working people in this country is not fake Scranton Joe, it's real President Donald Trump. Because they know that he has their best interests at heart. They know that when he was president for 4 years, groceries and gas and energy and housing were actually affordable to a normal person in this country. And after 4 years of the Biden administration, the basic trappings of a good middle class life have become less and less attainable.
So we know what he stands for when it comes to foreign policy, but when it comes to domestic policy, Vance is also expected to likely hit a few key points here. We know what his position is in and around, you know, supporting Donald Trump, describing him as a leader standing up to fight, especially after what happened on Saturday. Now, Vance did mention something about calls for unity today, though in the immediate aftermath of the assassination attempt against Donald Trump on Saturday, he blamed Joe Biden and Democrats, accusing them of using heated political rhetoric leading to this moment of political violence, even though we don't have any factual information about the motive of the shooter, at least at this point. We also know that J.D. Vance is one of the fiercest supporters of Donald Trump. He says that the 2020 election was stolen. He says if he was in the same position as Mike Pence, that when it came time to certify the 2020 election, that he would not have done what Mike Pence did. His position on abortion, he is anti-abortion with one restriction, the when a mother's life is at risk. So these are the kinds of things that J.D. Vance has talked about publicly as a senator, as a candidate running for office. But again, tonight, this will be the biggest platform he's ever had to really present the version of himself to American voters in the hopes of appealing to a broader audience.
Okay, so Katie, you mentioned the assassination attempt, and that's what I want to talk about next, because in the background of this political convention, there is this ongoing police, Secret Service, FBI, law enforcement, everywhere investigation. What's the latest on that?
Yeah, it is investigation upon investigation upon investigation. And really, when there is such a failure of security like that, none of that is surprising. The latest information we have about what's going on in Butler, Pennsylvania, and the investigation into the shooter, the 20-year-old man who lived not far, about a 40-mile drive from there, is that according to the Washington Post, the Secret Service was told by local police they didn't have the manpower to cover that building, the roof that the gunman was able to gain access to. And so this is clearly going to be a part of that ongoing investigation. Members of Congress were given an update this afternoon about how those investigations are going. There's an investigation into the Secret Service. There's the FBI leading the criminal investigation on the ground. At this point, we still don't have any new information when it comes to the motive here. There isn't a large social media footprint for the shooter involved in this attack, the gunman who is now dead. But those investigations, interviews with family members and friends continue. We also understand that on the day of the shooting, the shooter's parents assumed he'd taken his gun to go to the firing range to go and practice, and they actually called police to report him missing when he didn't come home. Of course, the shooting had already unfolded at that point.
Okay, Katie, thank you so much. That's the CBC's Katie Simpson in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Well, as the enthusiasm inside the Trump campaign grows louder, so too do the calls for U.S. President Joe Biden to step down. One of the most prominent Democrats in Congress, Adam Schiff, has joined the chorus of critics who say Biden won't beat Donald Trump and it's time for him to pass the torch. Now, despite those calls, there's now an effort to move up Biden's nomination as a Democratic candidate. The CBC's Richard Madden joins us now from Washington. So, Richard, what's happening with the nomination process? Let's start there first.
Yeah, absolutely stunning to see. The Republicans are the party that's falling in line, and the Democrats appear to be falling apart. And the latest sign that Joe Biden is digging in his heels and not going anywhere was this rule that the Democratic Party brass is pushing ahead, that they're going to follow through with what's called a virtual roll call ahead of their convention in Chicago in August. It's essentially for all the delegates from all the states to declare their support, throwing behind Joe Biden. And this is a way, this was a COVID era rule that they're continuing into this convention. It essentially avoids any kind of embarrassment, revolt, or confrontation that would play out on live television in August. This is a way for Biden to secure the nomination and essentially move on. There is a caveat, though, in this process is that they're not going to do the early roll call before August 1st. So those detractors who want Biden to step aside have about a week and a half to see if they can persuade the president to step down. But he is clearly not going anywhere. We've seen the president out on the campaign trail. He's in Nevada, which is typically a fairly lean Democrat state in the last few cycles. But that is now, according to polls, has become a toss-up. Biden is trying to do more outreach to Hispanics, African-American voters, in an effort to continue that to continue keeping that coalition that helped him win the keys to the White House in 2020. But polls are suggesting that those supporters are slowly drifting towards the Republican Party. He's also doing more outreach on media interviews to prove that he has the stamina, he's got the mental acuity, and that disastrous debate performance 2 weeks ago was a one-off. He spoke to Black Entertainment Television, David, in an interview, and he was asked about this lack of voter enthusiasm for Democrats in swing states like Atlanta, Georgia, and Detroit, Michigan, where there's a large contingent of African-American voters. Take a listen to how Biden responded to that enthusiasm gap.
Whether it's young Blacks or young whites or young Hispanics or young Asian Americans, they've never focused until after Labor Day. I mean, the idea they're focused intently on an election right now is not there. The point is, we're just getting down to game time now.
So game time is coming up pretty quickly, David. Several polls show Biden lagging in about 14 key swing states. Not a situation you want to have as the incumbent heading into November's critical election. Biden did say that he would step down if he had some serious health issue. So whether this is going to ease the panic within the Democratic Party that Biden is still viable at the top of the ticket, I'm not sure that put their concerns to rest.
Well, it certainly didn't ease Adam Schiff's concerns, and that matters because he's the latest Democrat to call for Biden to step down, and he's a big deal in Congress. How significant is this?
Yeah, to quote that famed philosopher Ron Burgundy, he is a big deal. He's one of the most powerful Democrats, most high-profile Democrats. He was a manager at Trump's impeachment inquiries, and he is about to become the next powerful senator of California, which is a very important state for the Democratic Party. But he came out saying that Biden should step down, he should exit the race, and that was a pretty stunning statement that he made. I'm going to read a little bit for you here. He said, and I'm quoting here, "While the choice to withdraw from the campaign is President Biden's alone, I believe it is time for him to pass the torch and in doing so, secure his legacy of leadership by allowing us to defeat Donald Trump in the upcoming election." He goes on to say, "A second Trump presidency will undermine the very foundation of our democracy, and I have serious concerns about whether the president can defeat Donald Trump in November." So clearly, not a message from unity coming from the Democrats, and it shows the deep divisions from within. As I said off the top, Biden has said he is not going anywhere, but it shows that a lot of Democrats are not taking his no for an answer.
Okay, Richard, thank you so much. That's the CBC's Richard Madden in Washington.
You bet.
All right, now we're going to turn to the big story here at home. The premiers are united in their frustration with Ottawa, and they say it's on multiple fronts. They say the federal government isn't spending enough money and fast enough on defense. They say it's not collaborating enough with the provinces, and they say they've had enough with the government putting its nose where it doesn't belong.
But it gets just a little bit frustrating with the duplication and the overstepping, so to speak, of the federal government.
We just want them to focus on their issues, and we'll focus on ours, and we'll get along just fine.
Like something's broken. They're wasting taxpayers' money. Go through the provinces, and you know what happens? The premiers get pissed.
Okay, we're going to get the federal government's response in just a few moments, but first, let's hear from the chair of the premier's meeting. Tim Houston is the premier of Nova Scotia and the host of the summer meetings of the premiers, and he joins me now. Premier Houston, welcome back to the show. It's good to see you.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
A lot of frustration from the premiers about the federal government barging into your jurisdictions, essentially telling them to stay in their lane. But I look at what the premiers are asking for. You've weighed in on defense spending. You want a greater say in fisheries management. Don't you need to respect their lane as well, Premier?
Yeah, for sure. Well, first off, the meetings, the COP meetings are an excellent time for all the premiers to get together and just talk about issues that they're facing and also opportunities. And it's a great table. It's a very collaborative table, so we can really focus on what matters to Canadians and hear those perspectives from across the country. So when we look at some of the federal government programs, you know, you think of the school lunch program directly in the wheelhouse of the provinces. Many provinces already have school lunch programs. We're already in the process of organizing one. Wouldn't it be a greater impact and more effective for Canadians if they would work with us on those types of things instead of surprising the provinces with their own initiatives that, you know, risk not really getting the outcomes that they want? So for sure, we feel very strongly that, you know, we have our jurisdiction and they have theirs and we can work together, but they need to respect our jurisdiction. In the case of the 2% NATO, a lot of people think of that, you know, exclusively as defense, but the premiers talked about the broader implications of meeting that obligation internationally and specifically in terms of our relationship with the United States. It's a significant trade. We're a trusted trading partner of the United States. There's a lot of movement of goods and people back and forth. And we're just worried that if the federal government doesn't fulfill that obligation, it has direct ramifications on the provinces in you know, trade and in the movement of goods and people. So, right. So we're asking them to honor their obligations because of the impact that it has on the provinces and on our economies.
But see, here's this is the weird thing about Canadian federalism, Premier, and the way jurisdiction works. Defense, foreign policy, international trade, that's their jurisdiction. Things like housing and education are your jurisdiction, but you all have a shared stake in it, and you're all accountable to the same voters. And they're frustrated by inaction on, say, the provincial and municipal end on housing, so the feds have to get into it, and now you're weighing in on defense. So, I mean, is this about jurisdiction or just a misalignment of priorities?
No, we're weighing in on, you know, the international obligation and the impacts it has on us. So movement of lobster, movement of seafood, movement of tires, movement of products produced by Nova Scotia, movement of energy in the case of other provinces and in Nova Scotia as well. You know, a federal government's decision to not honor our obligation has its own, you know, there are own issues with not honoring our obligations on the international stage. But then when you get right down into the impact, imagine if the United States, whatever the administration is, looks at Canada's failure to honor its obligations and says, here are the ramifications for that failure. Canada, we are now doing XYZ, whatever that might be. And that hampers our ability, the ability of our citizens, of our companies resident in our areas to trade products. And then that has an impact on our tax revenues, and that has an impact on our ability to deliver services. So this is a big global picture that impacts every single Canadian, and it's just one that we want to remind them, hey, honor your obligations. That's a very Canadian thing to do, and we want them to do that as well because of the ramifications, the very direct ramifications it has on Canadians.
So they've set the target of 2032, and that's the first time any Canadian government has committed to a specific date. You've written the Prime Minister saying speed it up if you can for the reasons you've outlined. Pierre Poilievre, who is the front runner to win that job in the election in the next year, year and a half, he said he's not going to hit that 2%, that he has no intention of doing it and thinks it's arbitrary. So what's your message to the Leader of the Opposition as the spokesperson for the Premiers right now?
Just my message to all Canadians, regardless of where they sit or their job or their position, is that this is really important and the Premiers see it as important. So, those are discussions we can have, but the first thing is to recognize the importance of Canada honoring its obligations on the international stage, but also recognizing that the failure to honor those obligations could have other ramifications, possibly unintended consequences on the economies and the trade of our country, but certainly of our provinces and territories. So it's just something we discussed. We discussed a lot of things. We discussed healthcare. We discussed all kinds of issues that are before us. And some are issues we sit down at that table and we say, what can we do? So what can we do on healthcare? That is a provincial responsibility. We hold each other to account. We share ideas on healthcare. We talk about files that matter to Canadians. This was just one of them. But it's a really important one, but there are many, many important ones.
Well, while premiers were talking about jurisdiction, the Prime Minister and some of his other ministers were rolling out public transit money today, announcing the details of the public transit fund, the Canada Public Transit Fund, that will start delivering money in 2026, mostly aimed at municipalities, which are in your jurisdiction, and which has conditions similar to the housing accelerator in terms of zoning and parking changes for municipalities to qualify for it. Is this an example of intrusion, or is this an example of something where you think you can work together with the federal government on these things?
Well, here's the simple reality. The simple reality is as much as the federal government wants to go past the provinces and territories into the municipalities, whatever it is they're trying to achieve, whatever deal they get with the municipality, it's very, very unlikely that it will be executed upon without the province or the territory participating. So they can dream up some schemes on housing, dream up some schemes on transportation, which are obviously very well-intentioned initiatives, and we support the intention behind those. But in the execution phase, whatever agreements they may reach with the municipality, they're going to, it's very unlikely that it's not going to involve the province. So just put us at the table to begin with and work with us on those issues. That's all we're asking.
But can the federal government...
And to make it happen.
Sorry, but can the federal government, in your vision of how this should work, come to the table with conditions on its money? Because it sounds like a lot of premiers kind of want the federal government to just adopt the provincial agenda as their agenda and design programs around that, when they have specific things they want to achieve as part of what they were elected to do.
We have shared priorities. They have priorities. We have priority. Most of the priorities are shared. So just work with us. I mean, we're there. We want to achieve outcomes for our citizens. We want to achieve outcomes for all Canadians. So we're there. We're an active participant in that process and a very willing participant. So just bring us stuff. Don't try to go around us. Don't try to cut us out. Don't try to find some scheme that you're not going to get the outcomes. You risk not hitting the outcomes. So just involve us at the beginning. That's all we ask. I don't think it's an unreasonable ask, particularly when we're going to be writing some of these checks anyway if they're going to work. So just put us there at the beginning.
Right. I can understand why you would want alignment on priorities and certainly on programs to get the best outcomes. But, you said living up to your obligations is the Canadian thing to do. The communique says our federation works best when all orders of government respect constitutional authority. How do premiers square that with what's happening in Saskatchewan, where Premier Scott Moe is not collecting and not remitting a tax that is within the federal government's jurisdiction to apply?
I think that's something that will be before the courts, and there'll be all kinds of arguments back and forth on that. But, you know, I have my own strong feelings on the carbon tax and the effectiveness of the carbon tax. I think it's debilitating to Nova Scotians. I don't think it helps advance the agenda, which is a common agenda, protect the environment. I don't think it advances that. So, like, this is just an example of an area where we can work together in Nova Scotia. We've put forward a plan. We've legislated environmental targets. We're serious on, you know, protecting the planet for future generations. We've laid out a plan that if the federal government would work with us, we could achieve the outcomes. That they've taken another course, which is not going to make achieving of those outcomes any quicker or any easier. In fact, it's probably going to make it more difficult to achieve the outcomes. It's a policy where we have a common goal, but different policy objectives, courses on that. So, again, if we would sit, as we're asking, and I appreciate your focus on this and your different angles on this, David, but I would just bring it back to a simple ask, and that's just to work with the provinces. We're willing partners on achieving these outcomes.
So just as a final question, because I know you have to run, it sounds like you have a lot to talk about with the Prime Minister. And I know you were requesting a First Minister's meeting earlier this year in the run-up to the April 1 increase in the carbon tax, which the majority of you oppose. Where are things on that front? Is there any sign of the Premiers and the Prime Minister getting together to talk about this working together between the provincial, territorial, and federal level?
I know there's a lot of people that are wanting to meet with the Prime Minister, including his own caucus.
He's in demand, yes.
But certainly, I would commit. I think I'd be safe to commit on behalf of the Premiers that if as soon as the Prime Minister is ready to meet with the Premiers, we'll be there. And there absolutely is a lot to talk about, and it can be a constructive conversation. But we just have to have it, and we're willing to have it.
Premier Tim Houston, thank you for taking the time to meet with me today. Thank you, sir.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me, David.
Provincial leaders wrapped up their annual meeting today with a message to the federal government to stay out of their affairs. No one expressed that more bluntly than Ontario Premier Doug Ford.
Like, something's broken. They're wasting taxpayers' money. Go through the provinces, and you know what happens? The premiers get pissed. Simple as that. And they jump in there, and they think they know better.
Despite that, the premiers did weigh in on federal responsibilities. They say Ottawa must meet the NATO defense spending target as soon as possible. Sean Fraser is the federal minister of Housing, Infrastructure and Communities, and he joins me now. Minister, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You have some angry and frustrated premiers not too far away from where you are in Halifax. They criticize the federal government's encroachment in their jurisdictions without adequate consultation or collaboration. How are you going to respond to that?
Look, I spend a lot of my time when I'm home in this constituency and visiting communities across Canada talking with ordinary people. And never once have I been asked to pick fights with another level of government or with a different political party. People don't want politicians to pick fights with one another. They want us to work together to solve problems. I never knew that it was controversial when we invest tens of billions of new spending in healthcare to insist that it goes to things like family doctors and mental health. I never understood the objection to investing in housing during a housing crisis to make sure that we're supporting cities who are actually making it easier to build homes. And when it comes to education, again, a provincial responsibility technically, I can't wrap my head around the objection to making sure that kids go to school on a full stomach. We don't want to pick fights. We want to be at the table to help solve problems. My hope is the Premier see a willing partner, despite their recent interventions at the Council of the Federation, indicating that they seemingly don't want us to be a part of these conversations.
Okay, a lot of premiers brought up school lunch, and I don't think they are ideologically opposed to feeding needy students. But they made the point that it's the process under which it was done, that it was kind of sprung on them in a budget with no real consultation on how to build the plan. And even on things that you're doing like pharmacare and dental care, they're worried about what happens in 5 years if you or a future federal government decides they're not going to fund these things and they're left with all of this infrastructure in place and without the money to support it.
And look, I agree with you. I don't mean to suggest that provinces don't believe that kids should have a full stomach. In fact, in my home province, I want to applaud the provincial government's efforts to actually advance work in this particular space. But this is something that should not come as a surprise. This is something that we campaigned on. It's something that was the subject of a lot of public conversation. And it's something that we've decided to take action on. When we're putting money on the table, if provinces don't want to be a part of that initiative, they're free to tell us that that's not something that they want our help with. However, the money is there, and my advice to them is that they should work with us to develop this program. We're going to have to work together, particularly if it's delivered in the school system. Again, the argument that you've raised when it comes to things like pharmacare or dental care, to me, it rings hollow. That's the kind of argument that I expect would be advanced by people who want to resist progress. It's true of any specific policy area that what one government does, some future government may undo. But if we fall victim to that analysis, we're going to find ourselves 10 years from now not achieving any progress. I always want to be on the side of people who are trying to do big things, solve big problems, and most importantly, help the people that we've been elected to represent. People don't live their lives in provincial and federal jurisdiction, but they expect those elected officials who serve in one chamber or the other to work together to help improve their quality of life in every community across the country.
Okay, so Premier Youssoum, who we spoke to earlier, said that none of your federal programs can work without the provinces getting involved. He's talking specifically about transit for municipalities, housing for municipalities, and they want to be in on those things at the front end rather than midway through the process, because the argument coming from the Premier's table is that it runs the risk of creating duplication with programs that already exist in various jurisdictions across the country, or maybe failing to deliver because it's not calibrated precisely enough for the specifics of a province. What's your response to that?
Look, first of all, hi, Tim. He's a neighbor. We work well together. We're from the same part of Nova Scotia. We've served the same constituents for a number of years. But let's take transit as an example. We made the announcement today about the largest investment in public transit in Canada's history. Within a few hours, I was actually on a call with the provincial minister here in Nova Scotia to discuss some of the work that they've been doing. And their message to me was, to date, there's been extraordinary collaboration between my office, between our department and their agency, who's actually developing a plan that will be built by Nova Scotia for Nova Scotia, but supported by the federal government. Anyone listening into that conversation would view that to be a model of how the process ought to work. When it comes to housing, one of my frustrations that I've experienced over the last couple of years is that the reason that we needed to incentivize changes at a municipal level is because those changes were not being made. Provincial governments actually have the legislative authority to make some of those changes without the significant public spend that we've had to put on the table to incentivize cities and communities of different sizes to make it easier and faster to build homes. We want to work collaboratively, but Canadians will be impatient if we let perfection be the enemy of progress. We need to get down to work to make sure we're advancing the priorities that people raise with us. These deals and ideas are not dreamed up behind closed doors on Parliament Hill. Right. They come from doorstep conversations with people in communities, and we want to make sure that we're meeting their priorities.
Okay, I do want to touch on housing, but I do want to ask you about this public transit announcement, which your government is billing as the largest public transit investment in Canadian history. And this release, dated July 17th, 2024, the Prime Minister announces the launch of the Canada Public Transit Fund, a new $30 billion investment over the first 10 years, and talks about $3 billion per year in stable funding. But I've got an announcement from the same Prime Minister from February of 2021, which talks about $3 billion per year for public transit to communities beginning in 2026, 2027. Isn't this the same thing that was announced 3.5 years ago? They're both not starting until 2026. It looks word for word, dollar for dollar, like the same program.
Oh, so easy point of clarity for you, David. The program opened today for the expressions of interest that can actually be submitted to tap into that investment. So this is the transit funding that we had budgeted a few federal budgets ago that is now open for applications for expressions of interest from the metro regions across Canada who are eligible for that same fund. So to answer your question directly, it's the same fund and it's now been opened.
Okay, so but it's 3.5 years from announcement to the ability to apply for it. I mean, is that quick enough for something with the urgent requirements of public transit, which is a big part of your green agenda and a crying need in municipalities?
So one of the things that's important to understand is this is not the beginning of the federal government's investment in transit systems. Mm-hmm. Previously, the Investing in Canada infrastructure plan had a significant chapter dedicated to public transit. during those past few years after the initial money was budgeted for this new transit fund, the former version of the transit support from the federal government was rolling out. There are projects that have been announced more recently over the past few years that are still receiving funding. What you see today is the opening of the next phase of public transit, so that there's that continuous, long-term, predictable source of funding for transit systems across Canada. So despite the fact it may have been budgeted for a few years ago, there has been a stream of public transit money that's been going to support transit organizations before the pandemic, during the pandemic, and since through previous programs. But it's important that we follow the proper budgetary process to actually get the authority to advance these programs through a federal budget and then release it as one program comes near its end to have something more substantial to carry us forward.
Okay, I gotcha. I appreciate that clarification. Okay, so on housing, this is something that you have been tasked with at the federal level of transforming for reasons of national interest, but also political interest because of the way it's become such a political issue. This is something that constitutionally the premiers are supposed to deal with. They basically delivered a message to your government to stay in your lane, essentially, how it's been described at their meetings this week. But then they also weighed in on international trade. They weighed in on the speed of your defense spending and urged you to accelerate hitting the NATO target. What do you make of this seeming contradiction in position that they are saying respect jurisdiction while telling you what to do, while you're saying you're barging into their jurisdiction on issues like housing because they fundamentally require action?
So I don't mind if others give commentary about areas of federal jurisdiction, despite the fact that they may not be elected to the federal parliament. And in fact, I find when you're dealing with elected representatives who talk to people who, again, live in communities, not in jurisdictional silos, that feedback can be very important and very welcome. But you're right, there's a heavy dose of irony that comes with it when in one breath we're told not to make investments in housing unilaterally, but in the next breath there's advice specifically on what we should do in areas of federal concern. It doesn't bother me though. My sense is when we have these conversations, we could actually achieve a greater degree of progress. I think people are sick and tired of politicians who spend their time and energy fighting with one another, and I don't mean to suggest that's all that that we do or that the premiers do. We've had great success working with Quebec to make one of the most significant investments in social housing with a $1.8 billion deal, a $2 billion deal with the province of British Columbia, who's been an absolute leader when it comes to housing. We've got opportunities that I've had personally to work with Scott Moe when it came to welcoming Ukrainians. We've got more and more examples we can point to, including the transit conversation I had with the Nova Scotia minister today. My goal right now is to focus on the problems that people raise with me in my community and across Canada. Sometimes that requires provincial cooperation. Other times we can act unilaterally. So if the provincial governments have feedback on areas of federal jurisdiction, I welcome it. I hope that they would demonstrate the professional courtesy to accept our help when we're trying to solve very big problems that may touch on their areas of competence as well.
The Prime Minister's office has released a letter responding to the Premier's concerns, suggesting that Dominic LeBlanc will set up a meeting with Premier Ford, who takes over as the new chair of the Premier's Council, and any other interested premiers. Shouldn't the Prime Minister be meeting with the First Ministers to talk about some of these issues? That feels like a Prime Minister to Premier conversation that needs to happen in this country.
The Prime Minister is engaged with the Premiers on a number of occasions, but don't forget that Dominic is also the Minister of Intergovernmental Affairs. He's got great relationships, not just with Premier Ford, but with Premiers and provincial representatives across the country.
But with respect to Minister LeBlanc, they do want to meet with the Prime Minister. I know a lot of people want to meet with the Prime Minister, but these are the Premiers, and they've been asking for a meeting for close to a year, if not over a year.
Certainly, and I find sometimes before you have a clear idea of what agenda items you're seeking to complete and to secure a deal on, you don't want to engage in creating expectations where that there's going to be some opportunity to make a deal when in fact there's no chance at real progress. When I see the tone coming out of the Council of the Federation today, my sense is the premiers wanted to score a political point by announcing that they don't like Ottawa doing certain things. If we get to a point where we need to negotiate the final portions of a deal on a given issue, whether it's healthcare, whether it's housing, whether it's the school food program, or whatever other issue you may see them discuss, I think there will come a time where it's essential for the Prime Minister to engage personally. But at this stage, when it seems that there's a lot of preliminary details to be worked out, it's an excellent idea to have a designated representative to deal specifically with intergovernmental affairs. And given the relationships and competence of my friend and colleague, Mr. LeBlanc, it's clear to me he's very well positioned to serve in that capacity.
Okay, I have one last question for you because I've gone over time. But What about inter-caucus affairs? You've seen the calls and the questions about the Prime Minister's leadership since the by-election loss. There's not going to be a full caucus meeting, but there are one-on-one reach-outs and group reach-outs happening. How would you describe the mood inside your caucus at this point in the summer?
My sense is most people that I work alongside are focused on the needs of the people that live in their communities. I've never once received questions about who sits in what chair. I find it sometimes elected officials can be arrogant that they think that's what's on people's minds at home. My colleagues that I've had conversations with over the past couple of weeks have been talking about what they're actually hearing from people at home. People are focused on things like the cost of living, whether they get a job to put food on the table, protecting our environment, making sure that there's enough houses for people to live in, and healthcare. If we remain focused on what people are focused on, we would do ourselves a great service as compared to focusing on what jobs politicians have instead of what jobs our constituents have.
Housing Minister Sean Fraser, always appreciate the time, sir. Thank you.
Anytime.
It's a wrap on the Premier's annual meeting in Halifax, and they ended with a pointed message for Ottawa: stop imposing your policies on provinces.
Like, something's broken. They're wasting taxpayers' money. Go through the provinces.
There's implications to these quick decisions you've made, and they're going to affect our economy.
We can't keep cutting our own sources of revenue because the federal government refuses to cut theirs.
We're all kind of bursting at the seams in relation to keeping up with housing. We're getting the pushback from many citizens about the cost and the affordability. And
you know what happens? The premiers get pissed.
Okay, the premiers are clear, but the federal government says Canadians don't want to see different levels of government bickering all the time.
Don't want politicians to pick fights with one another. They want us to work together to solve problems. When we're putting money on the table, if provinces don't want to be a part of that initiative, they're free to tell us that that's not something that they want our help with.
Okay, so does anyone come out ahead in these disputes other than journalists and political shows in the summer? We're going to talk about all of this with the Power Panel. Amanda Alvaro is a former Liberal Party communication strategist. Jordan Leichnitz is a former NDP strategist. And Tim Powers is a former strategist for conservative parties. All right, don't be alarmed, but the premiers are mad, right? It's summer. Amanda, though, do they not have a point that the federal government is sometimes springing things on them that requires them to come in with money or with responsibility without being consulted at the front end of things, the way it's gone the last little while?
Well, okay, I think a couple of things. I think that, you know, the premiers are in the enviable position of being able to pit the federal government as the foe. So if they want to play the blame game, this is a good opportunity to do it, and they can stand arm in arm. I think ideally, of course, everyone would like to see more of a kumbaya coming together to get the job done. But the federal government is also, they're in their last year of this mandate. They have to get this job done. They have things like dental care and pharma care and child care that, of course, requires the cooperation of the provinces. But they've also made these promises to Canadians. So it's kind of like they're in the position of, well, either the provinces are going to get on board and on side, and if they're not, then they need to get out of the way. Because certainly the federal government doesn't want to be in a position that they're being accused of dithering or that there's a lot of talk and not a lot of action. And we know that they've had that criticism in the past. So in a year where you're heading into the next election, I think it's more important for them to be seen by the Canadian public as the advocate, as the person who's going to get the job done. And if that means premiers get out of the way, that's what it means.
So Tim, is it... it's just a collision of political necessity with constitutional jurisdiction. I mean, the premiers had a lot to say about defense spending and international trade and all kinds of things that aren't their job today. It was interesting.
Normally, it's all of that. Just your summer brouhaha, provinces are always mad at the feds. That's not new. I think the new dynamic is this, that Justin Trudeau, for good or for bad, is seen to be very toxic. So every premier is running away from him at the moment because that's providing good politics for them at home. We've seen that from Newfoundland to BC. That is happening. The other dynamic...
Specifically, the two of them sitting together today.
Well, exactly.
Yeah, on equalization.
Some things bring the premiers together.
But also you have probably a little bit of, if Doug Ford was talking about pissing people off, there was a little sucking up going on. And it wasn't sucking up to Justin Trudeau. It was to Poilievre, right? I think all of them are looking at the same polls we are. None of them, again, because he is toxic, Trudeau is, want to be seen to be in line with him right now. They know in their minds, they probably think Pierre Poilievre keeps a list of who's being good and who's being bad. So nobody's going out on a limb to support them. A lot of the messages the premiers are giving are exact same messages that Poilievre is giving. So no surprise around all of those positions. I will say this, so interesting about getting programs completed, Amanda's point. You do see the difference in the dynamic because the federal government, when they brought in child care, after years and years and years and years, and we've talked about that on this panel very often, were able to eventually get everybody on board. But what was different then? Justin Trudeau's check also came with political capital. Right now, there's no political capital or the political capital that was there before.
Well, there's also, you know, widespread public support for the idea there's an economic value in investing in $10 a day child care, right? You know, that there's Jordan.
That was part of the political capital, I would say, that he had at the time that didn't exist before.
It's interesting, though, Jordan, and I've asked three premiers about this, because the line that jumps out at me in the communique is, our federation works best when all orders of government respect constitutional authority. And I asked them how they square that with Scott Moe not collecting and remitting the carbon tax. I was like, well, you're going to have that, Scott, even though they had 2 days of meetings with him. But what do you make of this? Stop doing things in our areas, but we want you to do these things in your areas because it's in our best interest dynamic.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's shocking, but I think it's political. You know, this is really just about they're each playing to their audiences here. And I think, you know, you see that really across the country, as Tim was saying. And the difference, I think, that we saw early on, you know, on the childcare as an example, is that there Trudeau had time, right? It wasn't just the political capital. He also had time to go and close the deal one by one with the provinces. And you saw this also with healthcare spending, where you had really, for example, strong criticism from Ontario and the Ford government early on, and then very quiet acquiescence and signing on a few months down the road. So typically, when the federal government comes in with a lot of money that's additional in these programs, people find their way around their feelings eventually and figure out a way to take that money in order to then deliver on their own election commitments to their constituents. Like, that's just smart politics for everybody involved. I think the difference right now is that time is just very compressed, right? So you have, of course, BC is heading into an election this fall. Saskatchewan is in an election. You've got, you know, you really are feeling the pressure in a number of provinces. And of course, time is very short in the federal scene and things feel pretty dire. So there's not necessarily that same room to maneuver for the federal government. And they always end up as the easy punching bag here.
Okay. And the U.S. is also heading into an election. And this is why I saw a lot of premiers talking about NATO targets and the pace of we just got a commitment of 2032, and now the premiers are saying you need to go faster, which is not the sort of thing that normally comes up at a summer meeting of the premiers, but they're worried about change in the U.S. and what a Trump-Vance, it's very different, same sort of different thing, might do. So
I'm just saving on those signs.
We have an interview coming up with Daniel Smith that I taped earlier, and I asked her about this. She's like, okay, you want the Liberal government to hit 2%. What about a possible future Conservative government? Because they've said they don't necessarily believe in hitting that target. Here's what Daniel Smith had to say.
Such a warm welcome. We don't want that relationship to be strained because the federal government in the U.S. retaliates against us because we're not meeting that military target. We're just trying to be proactive here. And absolutely, we will put the same pressure on the opposition leader if he also becomes prime minister.
So, Amanda, that's interesting. A lot of people were writing the current government and saying, you got to get to 2% or we're going to be diplomatically and politically isolated. And Pierre Poilievre said he wouldn't do it. Now Daniel Smith, a pretty prominent conservative and a supporter of him, says they should commit to it and they should do it. It's in the national interest. What do you think?
Well, I think Danielle Smith's brand is about really standing up for the things that she believes in. And if she seemed to like acquiesce even before somebody's in government, I think that would be a very strange position for her to take. This is her position, and be damned whoever is leading the country. So that wasn't surprising to me. What was a little surprising, though, was the premier's position on timeline. So we saw a Manitoba premier say, you know, it should be done in 4 years, not 6 years. And you can understand that, obviously, with the American election, there's going to be an emphasis on how to maintain this trade relationship. How do we have the best possible international relationships? But certainly, how do we keep our Canada-U.S. relationship at a prime? So they're feeding into what will be in the news and what will be in the zeitgeist. But with this commitment being made by the federal government only a week ago for 2032, it was a little odd to me that we saw this emphasis or this push for this four-year commitment as if those 2 years would be a make or break.
Right. Well, it's interesting, Tim, that they say the Fed should stay in their lane because they don't understand the nuances of things in the provincial level. Defense procurement's a whole other thing. I don't know if you could accelerate $20-odd billion a year at that pace, but Polyev said he won't hit 2%. Now, the conservative premier of Alberta, who wants him to be the prime minister, says he should hit 2%. What does that do to that conversation?
Makes it fun and interesting, David. I think of the things Pierre Polyev is worried about as it relates to his potential chances of getting elected. He's probably already got the safety and security crowd, and he will probably have a fairly ambitious agenda, I suspect, about investment in the military. So it's not a political vulnerability for him domestically. What I find interesting about the premier's comments, they're also sucking up. Maybe that's the theme of the meeting, and it has nothing to do with the prime minister. I mean, on two fronts. One, the trade between each province and the United States is, I think, the most significant trading partner for each province. Yeah. I would be shocked if that's not the case. So it makes just good sense. If Trump is going to win, you know what he's like. You know where he's going to go. You speak of somebody who keeps lists. He keeps lists. Secondarily, you know, from an economic development perspective, 2%, getting to 2% faster is going to be probably very good for a lot of provinces who saw their national defense capacities diminished over the years. I mean, you look at our region in Atlantic Canada, we used to have a ton of national defense investment. Alberta, air bases, Manitoba, Wapakoneta, same thing. It's a no-brainer for them to say this because it doesn't cut into their pot of money, and it perhaps, arguably, creates some economic investment in their communities if you accelerate the path to 2% more quickly.
Jordan, what do you make of the defense stuff and any other final thoughts on what's happening here?
Yeah, so I think this is so much about what's happening in the U.S. and the nervousness, I think, is really justified. The reality is that Trump is volatile. We don't know what he's going to do. And what he said he's going to do is alarming with respect to the trade relationship and potentially pulling out of NATO or not defending countries within NATO. So I think the nervousness is warranted. Where I'm not sure there's going to be as much of a wedge is on the timeline versus no timeline. Because the reality is 2032 is far enough out that we're not going to be meeting that target within, for example, the next Trump presidency. So the difference between having a target that we're not meeting and having a target that we don't have a timeline for is pretty slight in the next 4 years. I do think that there are ways, you know, and Premier Eby talked about this as well. There are ways that the federal government can be a little bit more creative in the accounting in terms of what counts towards military spending. And you see European allies doing this. You know, so for example, in Belgium, the rail system, because they use it to transport things to the front line in Ukraine, that counts towards their defense spending. So you could look at sort of similar things here, particularly in Canada, where our military investment encompasses so many other aspects of protecting people at home, like emergency response, wildfires, things like that. So I would expect to see some of that work happening and maybe bringing us a little bit closer to that goal as we go on.
So, Amanda, the federal-provincial relationship has been a bit rough now for a while, as we say. There was a response to some of this today from the Prime Minister's office saying they're going to get Dominic LeBlanc, the Minister of Janitorial and Intergovernmental Affairs, because he cleans up everything for them, to reach out to Doug Ford and other premiers who want to have a meeting to set up a meeting. But still no first minister's meeting, which is something Tim Houston and the premiers have wanted forever. I mean, at some point, don't all of these people need to sit down together and deal with all the things that they have in common and not in common?
But do they? I mean, I think, yes, in a perfect world, yes. But it's a little bit of a utopian view of what would happen in that meeting. And I think that the federal government recognizes that the strained relationship that has occurred means that they have to, and I'll go back to earlier comments, they have to push their agenda through. They have to be seen by Canadians to getting the job done, premiers be damned. And I think that getting in a room probably just ends up resulting in, you know, a lot of blame pushing, a lot of, you know, issues on the table, a lot of grievances being aired, but does it actually result in progress? So I think that they've put people in the window to say, listen, here's the person who's going to be our connecting voice, and here's somebody who's going to try to help push these issues forward. But the Prime Minister himself, I think him staying a little further back and being able to talk directly to Canadians versus being seen to be in a room where people don't like his agenda is the right move at this moment.
Okay, Tim, what do you think? Should he do it or not?
Whoever's producing tonight should dig up a tape circa me 2013-14 saying exactly the same thing about why Stephen Harper didn't like First Minister's meetings.
Yeah. They're always great when you're brand new.
Yeah,
right?
They're one. But I mean, and this Prime Minister was going to have more of them. He did, to be fair to him, during the whole COVID period.
Yeah.
But look, it's like having a caucus meeting for him now. If he has a caucus meeting, if he has a First Minister's meeting, maybe even his cabinet meeting Friday. It's not going to be a fun experience for him. And if you're Justin Trudeau and you're trying to save your regime and plot your way forward, I get why you don't want to have one. But at the same vein, you've just opened yourself up for more unhelpful criticism at this juncture.
Okay, Jordan, last word to you.
Yeah, I think there's absolutely no reason for the Prime Minister to want to go into one of those meetings and be a pinata. And that's what it would be. They're making the bet that Canadians care less about jurisdiction and more about the services that are being delivered and what's happening in their day-to-day lives, and that they can just wait this one out and eventually it'll blow over.
And, you know, the IMF is projecting this will be the hottest economy in the G7 next year. So, you know, the hope springs eternal for the turnaround that they've been counting on. So who knows? All right. I want to thank you all for being here in the summer. Jordan Likeness, Tim Powers, and Amanda Alvaro. Thank you to the Power Panel. Okay, we have some breaking news to bring you. U.S. President Joe Biden has tested positive for COVID-19. The White House confirmed it moments ago in a statement, but it was first announced by organizers of his campaign event set for tonight. Biden was supposed to speak to a crowd in Las Vegas 90 minutes ago, but the CEO of the event appeared on stage to say this.
Regrettably, I was just on the phone with President Biden. And he shared his deep disappointment at not being able to join us this afternoon. The president has been at many events, as we all know, and he just tested positive for COVID. So, of course, we understand that he needs to take the precautions that have been recommended, and he did not obviously want to put anybody at risk.
Now, according to the White House, Biden presented with upper respiratory symptoms, including a runny nose and a cough. He's received his first dose of Paxlovid. Biden is returning to Delaware to self-isolate and continue his presidential duties from there. And we'll continue to monitor this story and bring you any developments as they come in. Well, back to Milwaukee, where Ohio Senator J.D. Vance is set to deliver his first address as a Republican vice presidential nominee in just a few hours. It's his chance to show party supporters what he will bring to the ticket. Christopher Devine is an associate professor of political science at the University of Dayton in Ohio. He's also written two books on the impact running mates have on an election ticket, and he joins me now. Professor, it's good to see you. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you predicted that Donald Trump would select J.D. Vance as his running mate well before it was announced. You must have had an inkling. Why do you think he did it?
I've gotten plenty of things wrong about predicting politics the last number of years. But yeah, that is one that I thought made a lot of sense. I don't think it makes sense in appealing to voters. I can explain why. But in terms of Donald Trump's decision making, it did line up pretty well. And I say that because when we look back at the 2016 selection of Mike Pence, Donald Trump, reflecting back on that this time around, I think saw that as a bad choice, not because Pence hurt him in the campaign or did not serve him loyally in office, but really just that one thing on January 6th where Donald Trump asked Mike Pence to do something that the Constitution didn't provide for. Pence said no to it on that basis. And Trump has regretted that, apparently, or at least villainized Pence for it. I think this time around, he was looking for the type of person who, as he has indicated, J.D. Vance has, would have said yes to him on January 6th rather than no, like Pence did.
Yeah, Pence more of an establishment Republican, Vance more of what, a movement, a mega movement Republican? Would you characterize our differences in terms like that?
Yeah, it's a little hard to define. Populism, of course, is a term we hear a lot that can be, you know, hard to pin down. But J.D. Vance certainly is more of a populist conservative. You might frame that as America First conservative. Have it as you will. But he's someone who I think really doubles down on Donald Trump's agenda, the policies he stood for. He's not a moderating choice who's going to really challenge Donald Trump on a lot of policy views. If anything, he might encourage him to, you know, kind of escalate, whether that's in terms of policy or, you know, some of the other decisions he might have to make as president, or things he's inserted himself into, like January 6th electoral vote count, for example.
Yeah, that's right, because, you know, conventional or historic thinking was that you pick someone to balance out the ticket, to bring geographic or, you know, representation into play to help you. But you published an op-ed here saying that J.D. Vance is actually going to hurt Trump's campaign. And you wrote that he is the least qualified vice presidential candidate in modern history. Why do you think those things?
Yeah, I don't say that lightly, and I don't say it happily, and nor is it anything specific about this being the Republican VP pick. Look, Donald Trump was looking at two people in Marco Rubio, the Florida senator, and Doug Burgum, the North Dakota governor, who I would say clearly were qualified for that office. They would have been excellent choices, not just in terms of their ability to perform the role once in office, but also in convincing voters that Donald Trump was serious about a second term, about governing in a second term. The J.D. Vance pick is not one that sends that kind of a signal. Donald Trump has picked someone who only was sworn into the Senate, his first political office, last 18 months ago in January 2023. That's not something that really tells voters that Trump is serious about governing. They have to ask what other factors went into Vance's selection. And I think a lot of them have more to do with politics than they do to governance.
What political considerations, right? Because, you know, you think about balancing the ticket, but this in some way sort of amplifies what's already there in Trump, right? Given their sort of alignment on a lot of things. So what would be the political reasons that he'd go with J.D. Vance over, say, someone with more experience in the Senate or as a governor who has that executive level responsibility on their resume?
Well, the first one, again, is the issue of loyalty. But as I want to be clear in saying, you know, Mike Pence was loyal. That wasn't enough. He had some kind of outer limit on that, where at some point he was willing to tell Donald Trump no. And I think that's something that Trump just cannot tolerate. And so he wants someone who's going to be beyond that, more subservient or exhibiting fealty in that case, more so than even loyalty. So I think that's one consideration, especially if, you know, if we look forward to the counting electoral votes that Vance would preside over in January 2029. It's not Donald Trump running for a third term at that point. The Constitution doesn't permit that. But some other Republican, perhaps Vance himself, Trump might ask for something similar to that, or to back him up on other things that might push the boundaries of constitutional law, for example. But beyond that, I would also say in terms of politics, Trump always wants to reassure his base. You might think, well, the base loves Donald Trump. You know, what's there to convince them? Why are we bother trying to convince them? And I would say that Trump, I think, really just enjoys being the champion of the base of his party. He doesn't want to do anything that would raise doubts or seem like he's compromising on what it is that they want from him. And if he had chosen, let's say, a mainstream candidate like Marco Rubio, firm Trump supporter, but also more mainstream figure, by the way, voted to certify the 2020 election, for example, I think the base of the party might have had more of a problem with that, at least the kind of hardcore MAGA base. I think there are others in the Republican Party who would have liked that reassurance. Trump has not given it to them with this pick of Vance.
How do you think the base will react to some of the things that are being dug up in the Oppo research of J.D. Vance of saying, I can't tell if Trump is, you know, a cynical a-hole, I believe is the word, like Nixon, or if he's America's Hitler? I know he's come around big time on Donald Trump, but his history is punctuated with this criticism of the Republican nominee.
Yeah, J.D. Vance, you know, his response to that, I think, has been very clear that, and this goes back to the 2022 Senate campaign, he says, yes, he made those comments, but he's been convinced by Donald Trump. He didn't think that Donald Trump would be a good president. As he's put it, he was a great president, maybe one of the best presidents in his view. And so Vance owns those comments and says, my opinion has changed. Basically, give me credit for being honest. He says we owe it to the American people to be honest with him about these things. change my mind. And so he's portraying that as something that actually speaks to the strength of Donald Trump. If he can convince someone like me, he's basically saying, who, you know, called him America's Hitler and all this kind of stuff in 2016, all those other people who have been never Trumpers as he once was, or still harshly critical of Trump, he's saying they might change their mind too. They should change their mind and admit that they've been wrong as well.
Right. I look, there's so much focus on Joe Biden's age, but Donald Trump isn't exactly a young man either. There's only 3 years between them, regardless of their vigor levels. So we've got J.D. Vance and Kamala Harris. How do they contrast or resonate with the American public? How does that play in an election campaign where the age of the top of the ticket is such a big deal?
Yeah, you know, with the two of them, age is not a concern. By the way, with Donald Trump, even though objectively his age is up there, that's not far behind Joe Biden. You know, there's some dispute about, well, how sharp is Trump. But, you know, in comparison to Biden, I don't think that we're clearly seeing voters not nearly as concerned about Donald Trump's age. They're concerned about other things about it, but not his age. To the extent they are concerned about Joe Biden's age. That's not even close. Now, as far as their running mates, sure, that provides some reassurance about who could take over. Some people might find comfort in seeing Kamala Harris there as VP and say she's been in there a few years. She had a lot more experience before she got into the office, too, so she'd be ready to take over. Other people are not very happy with Kamala Harris. She pulls a little bit under Joe Biden. So, you know, she's not inspiring a ton of confidence from the American people either, whether that's, you know, deserved or not. Could provide some reassurance or not, depending on who we're talking about. J.D. Vance, you know, similar kind of thing, that here we have a much younger, he's 39 years old, he turns 40 next month, much younger vice president. Potentially, he would be the clear successor, constitutionally speaking, during Trump's next term. And so, again, people who like him would find that reassuring, but there are a lot of folks, if not based on politics or policy, then based on experience, might find that not very comforting that Vance is next in line.
So, Professor, just quickly, J.D. Vance is going to speak tonight as the first time as the official running mate. He's going to give the big speech on the big stage at the convention. What are you looking for in J.D. Vance's big speech tonight?
Yeah, I think it's an important speech for J.D. Vance. You know, we have to remember that as familiar as he is to those of us who follow politics closely every day, just enjoy this kind of thing. You know, for average Americans, they're not terribly familiar with him. And it's not just him. If you look back at the numbers from 2016, for example, only 39% of the American public could express an opinion one way or another about Tim Kaine or Mike Pence right after they were chosen as the running mates that year. That's typical. And that's about where J.D. Vance is, according to one poll of swing states by Bloomberg a couple months ago. Two-thirds of voters either had no opinion of J.D. Vance or had never heard of him, even though he's a best-selling author of Hillbilly Elegy, has made it to a movie, all this kind of stuff. So people have a lot left to learn about J.D. Vance. And so this speech is an opportunity for him and the Republican Party generally to tell a favorable story, a persuasive story about him. They're going to point to his experience growing up in relative poverty and you know, his ability to work his way up to where he is now. They might point to his military service, all kinds of things that would tell people a reassuring story about who he is and why he wants to be vice president. At the same time, by the way, that Democrats are going to be telling a very different story about J.D. Vance. Already we see them portraying him, introducing him to the American public as an extremist when it comes to issues about abortion in particular, they've said so far. They might also talk about his experience down the line. So we're going to be learning a lot more about J.D. Vance, and both sides are going to be trying to shape that story.
Christopher Devine, an associate professor of political science at the University of Dayton in Ohio. It was great to meet you. Thank you for joining us today, sir.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network with even more interviews. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochran. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.